Good morning. We're very happy to have with us today our colleague, our great colleague, Senior Judge Chip Erdman, only 2 weeks back from an extended trip to Australia, but he's flown from Helena, Montana to sit with us, and Chip, thank you very much. The first case today is United States versus Short. Is the appellant ready to argue? Is the government ready to argue? The appellant may argue.
Chief Judge Suzuki, judges of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Zach Shalegi, and along with Major Julie Borchers, I represent the appellant, Sergeant Brian Short. And Your Honor, although I know that my clock states that I formally request to...
Granted.
Your Honor, when it's too much, too much. This is a case where the prosecutorial misconduct is too much. Nine instances of the main complaining witness discussing uncharged misconduct outside of the military judge's 404B ruling or 412 ruling. Testimony about an uncharged sex assault, pornography, housebreaking, an uncharged aggravated assault. Statements from the accused where no Section 3 disclosure was even provided. 16 sustained objections, 2 motions for a mistrial, and 3 hours and 23 minutes of the complaining witness's testimony. Either the government didn't agree with the military judge's ruling that the evidence fell under 404B, or the government didn't simply understand 404B.
That raises something. In the last case we decided with facts like this, Hornback, there was substantial indication that counsel was simply so unprepared, so new, that he or she was incapable of getting stuff in without transgressing the rules of evidence and without transgressing the commandments of this court. Is this what we've got here, or what do we got here?
Well, Your Honor, although it doesn't necessarily matter whether it's malicious or just pure ineffectiveness.
Go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. But I think, Your Honor, here it clearly indicates that they clearly were not prepared, starting in the pretrial motions and moving towards the merits case. But eventually, after 40 sustained objections, 3 mistrials, it does begin to wonder whether or not it was just intentionally defying the judge's ruling. And I think some of the colloquies that the trial counsel was having with the judge, she, as well as the assistant trial, did not agree with the judge that some of this was 404B. And because of this, Your Honor, the government's actions, Sergeant Short didn't receive a fair trial, and this court should set aside the findings and sentence. In addressing the Fletcher factors, I specifically want to address the severity prong in 2 parts. The repeated violations of military judge's order, restricted evidence under 404B, that was both pervasive and severe, and as indicated that this is worse than Hornbeck, and the improper argument that permeated the entire findings argument. Furthermore, the curative instructions adopted by the military judge were insufficient. No curative instructions could have cured this prosecutorial misconduct.
Well, the military judge certainly strove manfully, repeatedly sustaining objections. What you're saying is that the well is so polluted that the judge couldn't do, regardless of what he did?
Yes, Your Honor.
The thing was beyond rescue?
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor. It was beyond repair. And as the trial progressed...
Well, so what's the judge supposed to do?
Well, Your Honor, and I apologize for the historical analogy, but the military judge is not a potted plant. He has a duty to preside and ensure that
this judge
trial.
Sure did.
Your Honor...
You know, the defense got pretty much what it asked for. So I ask again... What's the judge supposed to do?
Your Honor, the defense counsel asked for curative instructions. And
they got them.
On 3 occasions, the judge provided specific curative instructions, such as throwing the beer can, regarding the other egregious evidence. But on the other occasions, the judge simply stated, disregard that last statement, and it was a generic instruction. Furthermore, Your Honor, when the military judge was moved for three mistrials, although he did not grant the mistrials, that implies that the other corrective actions that were available to the court could have been considered by the military judge.
Is your position, counsel, that the military judge had to grant a mistrial under the circumstances here? Because it seems to me that that's what you're saying, and that, in effect, you want us to grant a mistrial on appeal.
Your Honor, we think that the military judge was wrong in not granting the third mistrial as it went through. However, the issue before the court is the overall context of the prosecutorial misconduct and how that impacted the panel conviction, not necessarily the mistrial. That misses the forest to the trees, Your Honor.
Counsel, are you proposing any specific language for a standard that this court should apply in regard to when too much is too much, or are you simply saying, based on the specific facts of this individual case, too much is too much?
Your Honor, I believe that this specific case, too much is too much. And the court has outlined through its case law the three factors. And as the court's aware, that many of them don't meet the prejudice standard. But here, clearly, the weight of the evidence was so weak that we cannot be sure that the panel convicted him on the permissible evidence alone, Your Honor.
Can you address that point,
yes, Your Honor,
in terms of the third prong of Fletcher? Can you address, please, the quality of the evidence in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, the complaining witness, NS, her credibility was directly attacked by the defense, and that was for which many... Her statements were for which many of the charges were based. She thought that Sergeant Short was cheating on her. There were allegations of infidelity as far as her motives for bringing this. She was in a custody battle for her son. Furthermore, Your Honor, the trial counsel specifically vouched for NS's credibility during closing arguments. She specifically said that she was telling you the truth, all of the truth, nothing but the truth. And later on, in a second instance, when she vouched for that credibility, she said she, the complaining witness, is telling the truth, and she's told you the truth about everything.
Okay, but you've addressed how defense sought to attack the credibility of the witness, and you've addressed now the vouching issue. But I'm asking something a little bit different, not the attacking of, but the undermining of, the quality of the evidence here.
Yes, Your Honor. In Sewall, there was inculpatory evidence to investigators, as well as digital evidence from the phone. Pablona, there was corroboration evidence from the testimony of his roommate, as well as documentary evidence. Here, there was no physical evidence. It was a total of three witnesses, and two of the witnesses, notwithstanding the complaining witness, there were difficulties in even getting evidence in. It mostly addressed... And I quote the trial counsel as later subsequent statements that they were trying to get in, and inartfully, many of those went before the panel. So, Your Honor, compared to Sewall and Pablona, the evidence here was simply just that, the testimony of NS. Furthermore, Your Honor, most of the violations of the 404B that were either outside of the judge's ruling or weren't even provided in a 404B ruling came from NS herself.
Counsel, if the curative instructions had no effect, how do you explain the mixed findings?
Your Honor, the mixed findings, if you look at the findings, Your Honor, the judge did provide some curative instructions. And when he provided curative instructions, that was for the egregious violations. That specifically went to the egregious for which the appellate was acquitted. However, the generalized instructions, we see a correlation there to the propensity to beat your wife or the assault charges, and he was convicted of those. So there is, upon close reading, there is some correlation there to the type of instructions or lack of specific instructions and the actual conviction.
What you're saying that he took more care with serious transgressions. What, isn't that a logical thing to do? And the venial sins, he simply said, disregard that. And you're saying he didn't do enough on the venial, he did enough on the mortal?
Exactly, Your Honor. And I think taking the instances each separately, one can understand why a judge may not see that as very prejudicial. But overall, the impact of that throughout the entire trial as
well.
Or maybe
he just got sick of it.
And I would agree, Your Honor, as we saw the military judge at once arguing everyone to come back to his chambers, although we unfortunately do not know what was discussed during that 802 session. But I think the prejudice...
We don't have just mixed findings here. We have findings of LIOs. I mean, it's not like the panel here just willy-nilly convicted of all the offenses. It seems like they parsed the evidence fairly carefully.
Yes, Your Honor, they were convicted of some of the LIOs, but even one of the charges, as a matter of law, was determined by the judge that the government failed to even show that there was even force, and that was regarding the shampoo bottles, that none of them actually even hit them. So as a matter of law, and the panel actually convicted him of the assault consummated by battery before the judge sent it back to them and said, no, as a matter of law, that he did not actually hit her with the shampoo bottles. So there, they failed the 917 motion.
Counsel, in your brief, you note that if it's preserved by objection, appellate courts review allegations of prosecutorial misconduct de novo. But here, isn't really the heart of this matter the military judge's denial of the motions for mistrial? And when we review denial of motions for mistrial, we give the military judge quite a bit of discretion.
Your Honor, for prosecutorial misconduct, it is simply a greater. It is whether or not the court can be confident that the panel convicted Sergeant Short on the basis of permissible evidence alone. That's not necessarily simply, although, Your Honor, we agree that you know, the judge should have granted the mistrial. That is missing the forest through the trees, is that it's a greater context of how everything and the cumulative impact on that, whether or not we can be sure that the appellant was convicted of that.
But once he denied the mistrial, I mean, it seems to me that our case law says that we give them a great deal of deference in that determination. How does that fit in? I mean, I understand your arguments, you know, as the underlying conduct and then the judge's determination. But are we really looking at this de novo, or are we looking at what the military judge did?
Your Honor, we're looking at this de novo regarding everything, the impact. And I understand that the military judge's ruling, there were three instances there of where the military judge was moved for a mistrial, and that the military judge denied that mistrial, restating the standard for granting a mistrial.
Instead, he gave curative instructions upheld objections by the defense counsel, and you're saying that wasn't enough. You needed to grant a mistrial, right? That it couldn't be enough, and that's why you're here complaining about the prosecutorial misconduct.
Yes, Your Honor. A mistrial is appropriate when the inadmissible evidence are so prejudicial that a curative instruction would be inadequate. And here, the curative instructions were inadequate.
But I think that Judge Erdman's point is the standard of review for a denial of a motion for mistrial is different, isn't it?
The standard, yes, Your Honor. And here, the standard of review for the objection, when preserved by error, would be de novo. But for when it's not preserved by error, it's, as in Sewell and Pablona, is plain error.
So, counsel, does that put defense counsel in a catch-22 position? If they merely ask for curative instructions and not for mistrial, the standard is more favorable to the defense, but we could then say, well, the defense did not ask for a mistrial. Therefore, curative instructions were sufficient.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, I would rely back to that the military judge simply isn't a referee, or is more than just a referee. He has a duty to ensure that all options available to the court are there, even if the defense counsel doesn't ask this. Here, the defense counsel asked for the mistrial. But
what should the military judge have done in this case that he didn't do? Specifically.
Well, for example, Your Honor, the military judge, although he did call multiple 39A sessions, and he tried to clarify his 404B ruling, but as the government's brief states, some of the clarifications did not prevent the missteps by the prosecutor in future conduct. He could have issued repeated curative instructions, which he did, just as in Hornback. However, in Hornback, the military judge there elicited responses from all the members of the panel to ensure that they understood the 404, or that they could not consider that evidence. They could have issued comprehensive instructions during the closing arguments. And the instructions that were provided by the court to the members only addressed KP and the evidence that she brought in.
Counsel, I know you don't have much time left, but could the military judge have decided to abate the proceedings until the trial counsel's supervisor did something about this? Is that within the military judge's authority to do?
Yes, Your Honor. As we know, only the accused is entitled to their choice of counsel. The military judge simply could have stopped and abated the proceedings and had the supervisor provide a new counsel until one that was either understood the rule or would comply with the rule come and act on behalf of the government, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government may argue.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Harris, and along with my co-counsel, Major Tinsley, we represent the government. The government should affirm the findings and sentence because trial counsel did not commit prosecutorial misconduct. Furthermore, any improper testimony was cured by the judge's instructions, and the panel convicted appellant on the admissible evidence alone.
Could you speak up just a little?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Looking at the type of prosecutorial misconduct that is alleged here, going back and looking at the specific number of objections, although 23 objections were granted during the primary witness testimony, only 8 of those were related to 404B. And of those 8, only one of those questions was an objection based on a question that was elicited by the trial counsel. The other 7 objections came from answers from the witness. That is telling to show that although the trial counsel was not purposely eliciting the information that was outside of the 404B lines, the witness perhaps was going beyond the left-right limits.
Well, when you say it wasn't eliciting the answer, let's get down to brass tacks a little bit. When we're talking about the garage incident, trial counsel asks, was the sex consensual?
Yes, Your Honor.
There was no reason for the trial counsel to ask that question. There was zero relevance to this court martial. Then the trial counsel is shocked by the answer given. So how do you say the trial counsel did not seek to elicit this information?
In that case, Your Honor, the trial counsel was trying to set up that although the sex itself was consensual, that the part of her hitting her head, or the part of him hitting her head into the trunk, was non-consensual. So the trial counsel was trying to parse out that, yes, although they were having sex and that part was consensual, that him hitting her head against the trunk was not consensual.
And how do you, when you say didn't elicit this information, the military judge before the court-martial had ruled on 404B evidence. The day before the trial counsel submits another motion. The military judge says, out of the 5 paragraphs in this motion, 4 of them violate my order. So why shouldn't that alone cause us concern?
Your Honor, looking at the answer by the trial counsel when the judge asked that question, what she said was, yes, Your Honor, they are exactly the same or very similar. The only new paragraph is paragraph 5. However, I submitted the motion in the same manner as I did the first time in an abundance of caution. She said, I don't want the defense to think I'm changing things or slipping new things in. So she said she essentially cut and paste the first motion, submitted the second motion, and added paragraph 5 just in an abundance of caution to show the defense that she wasn't changing anything that she had previously submitted to the judge. And there is a little bit of back and forth between the judge and the trial counsel. And he said, so, okay, do you understand the 404B? And she said, yes, I do, Your Honor. Paragraph 5 is the only new one, and confirms that with the judge. So looking at the answer of the trial counsel, Your Honor, it appears that she understood the ruling, tried to stay within those limits, but instead had a witness that was maybe going a little bit beyond the left-right limits of the 404B motion.
Did she explain it to the witness?
Yes, Your Honor.
The effect of the judge's ruling?
Yes, Your Honor. In one of the 39A sessions, she said that she did explain it, that she wasn't sure that maybe the witness didn't completely understand. And I think looking at the trial as a whole, we have a two-year relationship that's domestic violence. The witness is on the stand telling her story, and it may have been difficult for the witness to understand, not having the rules of evidence or having that background that attorneys do, why some of this evidence is important and why other part of the evidence is not. So trial counsel did do that, Your Honor. However, maybe she didn't do it good enough.
Well, yeah. I'm going to ask you what I asked the appellant. Is this a case of inexperienced blundering, or is this a case of something more? It sounds to me like trial counsel is happy as a hog in slop to have her witness chatter on about this impermissible stuff and try and get as much of it in as possible. I mean, what's going on here?
Your Honor, this is not a case of intentionality, although that is not necessarily required for prosecutorial misconduct. But in this case, trial counsel interrupted her own witness 23 instances. So trial counsel was trying to keep her in line, trying to keep her within the left-right limits, and doing the best that she could and confirm that with the judge. In another 39A session, the judge, they go back and forth a little bit, and she says, okay, judge, just to be clear, can I ask this? But can I ask this? So the trial counsel was trying to stay within those lines. And a very good example is one of the specific questions she asked, regarding the forcible sodomy. She said, was he holding you by your head or your hair? That's a very specific question that requires a one- or two-word answer, and yet the witness goes on seven sentences and said, he was pushing my head, he did this, then he threw the beer can at me, then he poured it all over my head, then he called me a name. And seven sentences later, in the joint appendix, page 111, you see that the witness is sort of going off of the rails, where the trial counsel asked a very specific question.
Well, isn't it within the trial counsel's duties and responsibilities to control his or her witness?
Yes, Your Honor. That is within the trial counsel's responsibility, and she was doing that to the best of her ability. However, no matter how much you prep a witness, you don't always necessarily know how they will act on the stand. And again, we have a witness here who is experiencing 2 years of domestic violence. She's on the stand. She's trying to tell her story and not necessarily understanding why some of it matters. And
sounds to me like she didn't prepare her witness.
Your Honor, the trial counsel did state that she did prepare her witness. However, the witness was trying to give an example of this is how the marriage was. It wasn't necessarily similar.
Which is what the military judge said could not be done.
Yes, Your Honor. And the judge did a very good job of that with the curative instructions.
Now, you yourself in your brief refer to the curative instructions using the terms multiple and escalating.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why shouldn't this court be concerned in any case where a military judge is in a position where he or she has to give multiple and escalating curative instructions?
Your Honor, in this instance, the judge is the arbiter of the case. So in this instance, the judge started with the curative instruction, and then it became more escalating because there were repeated violations, not necessarily because of questions elicited by the trial counsel, but because of the answers of the victim. She was getting nervous. She was getting frustrated. 22 times in the record it says the witness stops. She
well,
looks
you
up,
can't just – the witness isn't sitting up there in a state of immaculate conception. The witness is answering questions from the trial counsel. The trial counsel, you can't just draw a fence around the witness and, oh, well, it's the witness's fault. It's not the government's fault. So sorry.
Yes, Your Honor. And I believe that the trial counsel was doing her best to control the witness, and in the multiple 39.
So now it's back to, it sounds like it's back to inexperience, and this whole thing is just careening out of control, and the witness is prattling along, and the trial counsel doesn't know what to do, and the judge is giving multiple and escalating curative instructions, and the thing just goes off the rails.
Your Honor, it did not go off the rails in this case because the judge kept it within the bounds of where it needed to be. Within the 39A sessions, he specifically excluded the panel, sent them out, and discussed things further so that the panel did not hear the information that wasn't supposed to come out.
Counsel, I just want to clarify exactly what the government's position is. It seemed like initially you were arguing that there wasn't any prosecutorial misconduct. Now it seems like you're arguing that the curative instructions were appropriate to cure what? Prosecutorial misconduct. So is your better argument that there was no prosecutorial misconduct, or is the better argument there was some prosecutorial misconduct, but it was taken care of by the curative instructions?
Your Honor, the government's position is that there was no prosecutorial misconduct because of when you're looking at the number of questions and the number of responses that the witness gave and the objections were drawn from the witness. However, there was error. The government's position is that trial counsel may have invited error or may have asked inartful questions. And for that inadmissible evidence that did in fact come in, albeit though it wasn't directly because the trial counsel eliciting that on purpose in violation of the judge's 404B ruling.
Well, if it was error, what kind of error was it?
Your Honor, it was an artful trial counsel. It was an artful trial counsel answers, possibly not prepping the witness enough. However, there
what
was
about
in
the argument. What about the statements made during closing argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
I think the point is, there's nothing in this trial that the government should be supporting or saying is good, and you don't have to have intentional conduct for it to be prosecutorial misconduct.
Yes, Your Honor. Right. Yes, Your Honor. You do not have to.
I mean, I don't like to hear the government standing here and suggesting that this was a good trial.
Yes, Your Honor. There were definitely errors, and the judge's instructions, the judge's curative instructions and 39A sessions worked to overcome that evidence. And also looking at the third Fletcher factor, the panel convicted the appellant on the basis of the evidence alone. Looking at the eight specifications, only four for which he was found guilty. Four other specifications, he was acquitted. And of the four that he was found guilty, two were by a lesser included, whereas the other two were not. So the court can be secure that the panel convicted appellant on the basis of evidence alone, and that even the impermissible evidence that came into the trial that should not have did not prejudice the appellant.
Captain Harris, we have this longstanding presumption that the members understand and follow the instructions of the military judge, do we not?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, at what point does that presumption fail? Surely there must be a point, or do you think that there's nothing in the record here that suggests that it was too much, that the presumption should fail? Obviously, that's your position, I would suspect.
Yes, Your Honor. Case law shows that there is a point where that happens. Although we can't know exactly what the panel members were thinking, we can look at the findings. And especially as U.S. versus Sewell talks about mixed findings.
Is that all we look at, is the findings?
No, Your Honor. We can also look at what the panel is doing during the trial. So when the judge gives the curative instructions, the judge asks, can you comply with that, and asks for head nods, which he did and which the panel did in response. The judge
does anybody ever say, have you been at a trial where any member says, no, I'm not going to follow the judge's instructions? Don't they always say that?
Your Honor, the judge is the best one to judge that at the moment, sir. And so I believe that if the judge is saying, can you comply with that, the panel is charged to do that. And if they're saying, yes, we can comply, and nodding their heads, then the judge is the best one to discern that they are, in fact, listening to the admonishments of the judge and will take that into effect.
Also, would you agree that we would be in a different position in this case if there hadn't been a mixed verdict?
Yes, Your Honor. It appears that there could have been potentially more, it appears that the panel could have been possibly influenced, or you could make the assumption that they were influenced if they just said, this guy's a bad dude, he hits his wife, we're just going to convict him of everything. But looking at the specific things for which they found him guilty of, there was good evidence in the record that produced that. And for the things that they found him not guilty of, that also correlated with specifically what the panel heard. For example, with the shampoo, they convicted him of the lesser included specifically based on what they heard and what the judge ruled. They could only find him guilty of the simple assault. With the pulling her hair and restraining her head, she had very good testimony. She talked about details. She knew where her son was, what he was watching on TV when it happened. She remembered, "Not in front of my son." For the specification of dragging her by her hair that occurred in Florida, they convicted him of the lesser included. So they said, no, this wasn't assault to commit grievous bodily harm, but it was assault consummated by a battery based on her detailed description of the event, the memories. She was saying, I was thinking someone could hear me. I remember being on my knees. I remember how it felt. And then again, striking on her legs with his hand, she gave a detailed description of the assault. But for the four charges for which he was found not guilty, it also shows that the panel listened to the evidence, because the forcible sodomy he was found not guilty of, she said, I had been drinking. I asked him the next day what had happened. I told my neighbor that it was, that was the first one, and the brother and girlfriend were outside, and then there's no witnesses. So it appears that the panel listened to the evidence, that the curative instructions worked, that they listened to what the judge said, and they found him not guilty of that. Same thing with shoving her head into the car. That was the first one. The forcible sodomy was where the brother and the girlfriend were outside. Another specification was where he hit her in the head in Florida, and she didn't provide testimony about that at all. So the panel was listening to her, and even though they heard impermissible evidence, they didn't just say, well, he's a bad guy, and he dragged her by her hair and hit her on her legs, so he probably hit her in her head too. But that was the same exact incident. So we have three specifications in one incident. They found him guilty of two, and of the third one, they found him not guilty. I believe that shows that the panel is listening very specifically to the evidence and that the curative instructions are working and they are following the judge's instructions. For the last specification, striking her in her face with his fist, there was effective cross-examination by defense counsel. They elicited from her that sometimes they had consensual sex that included slapping, and that possibly was what changed the panel's mind to find him not guilty. Therefore, a very telling way to measure the panel's adherence to the judge's instructions is to look at the verdict. And when we have a mixed findings, that also reassures us that the panel convicted the appellant on the basis of the evidence alone.
Counsel, I'm somewhat concerned by what seems to be an undercurrent in your argument in response to the question from the chief judge having to do with intentionality and so forth on the part of the trial counsel. It almost seems as if the government's argument is, give the trial counsel a break. Be fair to the trial counsel who is inexperienced. But that's not the standard. The standard is we need to make sure that an accused has a fair trial. Here, the government chooses who's going to serve as a trial counsel. The government chooses what type of training and the extent of the training of the trial counsel. The government chooses how a trial counsel will be supervised. Here, the ball is in the court of the government. How is it wrong for a court of appeals to hold the government's feet to the fire and say, you have this ability to prepare your trial counsel to give a fair trial to an accused? And we are going to hold you to that standard.
Your Honor, that is a proper standard to hold. The trial counsel is charged with conducting herself or himself in a proper manner. And looking at the definition for prosecutorial misconduct, the trial counsel must stay within the bounds that the office is charged of an officer in that office conducting a criminal trial. However, in this case, Your Honor, even if there was prosecutorial misconduct, the findings should be affirmed because under Hornback and Fletcher, even despite prosecutorial misconduct, the curative instructions worked, and the mixed findings guarantee us that the mixed findings tell us that the panel convicted the appellant on the basis of the evidence alone. Now, while the trial counsel may have made missteps, it was not misconduct because looking at the number of questions and objections. Now, in Hornback, there was actually 12 times where improper 404B evidence came in. And in this case, there was only 8. So although there's not a specific number per se, this falls below the Hornback.
So you're going to start looking at these cases based on the number of instances? Has the government read Pavlona, Sewell, Hornback, Frye as meaning that the government can act with impunity in these types of cases in terms of repeated prosecutorial misconduct, where prior to the trial starting, you've got this issue where, and I understand your point about the trial counsel just trying to make it clear with its filing that it's not changing anything, but the record reflects that the military judge felt quite differently. Furthermore, we've got 3 days of trial. It wasn't just one day. Furthermore, we've got repeated incidences where the military judge has to get involved. We've got the military judge at one point, and there is an exclamation point in the record of trial, where he's saying, everybody back in my chambers, where is the supervision? Has the government misread our cases to say that trial counsel, we can claim that there was inexperience, and we're not going to hold it against the government, and the accused's right to a fair trial isn't really fully protected?
Your Honor, the government has read those cases, and the government agrees that trial counsel should be held to the fire, and trial counsel should not be allowed to just claim inexperience for errors. However, in this case, the trial counsel's actions did not amount to prosecutorial misconduct based on what she was asking and how she was asking it. Trial counsel does have the duty, and trial counsel cannot simply claim, I didn't know, I should have known better, or something like that with impunity. However, in this case, in order to overturn a case, even if there is prosecutorial misconduct, it doesn't automatically require a new trial or dismissal. Case law shows us that we look at the cumulative impact on the trial and the fairness in the trial. And in Hornback, while the trial counsel had multiple violations over multiple witnesses, this shows more that there was one witness that had a problem, not multiple witnesses spanning throughout the entire trial. Even if this court does find prosecutorial misconduct, appellant did not suffer prejudice.
Thank you. Does the appellant have rebuttal?
Chief Judge Suki, members of this panel, this court, I would like to address the government's assertion that simply NS was a rogue witness. The military judge provided his written ruling to the parties well before the beginning of trial. The government then submitted a 404B ruling the day before trial, or a 404B notice the day before trial that just added on, and some of it was contrary to the military judge's written ruling. Rather than prepare the witness, NS. And the government trial counsel admits on the record that one of the reasons the witness is testifying differently is because they did not have a chance to prepare that witness until the night prior and inform that witness, the complaining witness, of the judge's ruling. And specifically, the trial counsel asked the military judge if that she would have the opportunity to take that witness aside and ask them questions and practice those questions outside the members.
Counsel, could you please address this issue of raised by the government about being able to discern here that there really wasn't any prejudice, where the panel members here seemed to convict on those offenses where the evidence was strongest and found lesser included offenses? Why shouldn't that cause us, as a court, to look at the Fletcher prongs, the third one, and say, in the scheme of things, this may have been prosecutorial misconduct, a number of instances that are of grave concern, but in terms of prejudice to the accused, we don't find it?
Yes, Your Honor. The panel listened to the specific curative instructions, and where there were general instructions, there were convictions. There were guilty findings. Specifically, the simple assault. The 404B evidence that was inadmissible and came in related to the propensity to commit assault by the Sergeant Short. And that's exactly what he was convicted of. He was convicted of the assault charges. You even have the court where the members even found him guilty of throwing the shampoo bottle, of the actual assault, but according to the military judge's instructions. But then, after the 917, the members came back, and the military judge informed them that after reviewing it, that, in fact, as a matter of law, the government failed to prove that the shampoo bottles actually hit them.
But, counsel, the only thing he was charged with, other than that 125, were instances of assault, right? Violation of Article 128?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the fact that those are the only offenses that he was convicted of is not surprising, is it? What else could they convict him of other than the things he was charged with and LIOs? And he was also found not guilty of charges of assault.
Yes, Your Honor, but the propensity evidence here specifically related to his propensity to assault, to beat.
Right, but I think that Judge Olson's question was, given the fact that they found him guilty of some and not of others, why should we find prejudice?
Your Honor, I believe that goes to the fact that we cannot be sure that evidence did not taint the overall findings of the panel members.
Well, that's an ipsy dixit.
Yes, Your Honor, it is. And
why can we not be sure?
Your Honor, because the propensity evidence all colluded and it was...
Well, you're back to this correlation theory. Bad instruction, conviction. Good instruction, acquittal. That's your position, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Other questions?
I do have one, Chief Judge. Counsel, as I understand the sequence of events regarding the motion for finding him not guilty, is that with regard to that offense, the members were sent out, and then the motion was actually decided after the members were deliberating. Is that not correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, once the military judge rules on the motion in favor of the defense, then the members come back, and it appears that they have convicted on the greater offense. Isn't that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, does that suggest that they were listening to the military judge's instructions or not throughout the trial? Or does it suggest that they considered some of the evidence that they shouldn't have considered? What is your view on that particular offense, and does it inform a view of the remainder of the findings?
Judge Suki, may I have time to answer?
You may answer the question.
I apologize for having a lengthy question.
You may answer the question.
Your Honor, I think it presumes the latter, that essentially they took all the propensity evidence and disregarded what evidence was even there, the lack of evidence that actually a shampoo bottle hit the NS. And it convicted him because of the propensity to commit assaults. Pending any questions, Judge Suki, members of this court.
Thank you. Case is submitted. Court thanks counsel for both sides. And the court is in recess until 10:30.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 10:30.